Did you know the risk of cancer does not stop at the scene of a fire? Firefighters are constantly exposed to diesel exhaust fumes and other airborne toxins that get trapped inside the station. Protect yourself with MagnaGrip through the combination of MagnaGrip exhaust removal systems and AirHawk air purification systems. Learn more at MagnaGrip.com. This fire engineering podcast is made possible by Tincata Protective Fabrics. The global leader in flame-resistant fabrics, Tincata Protective Fabrics enables millions of people worldwide to be great at what they do. Generations of industry professionals serving in the fire service, industrial, and military industries rely on Tincata Fabrics for safety, comfort, and confidence. From the harshest working conditions to the welcoming site of home, Tincata recognizes the people they're protecting are unique individuals whose lives extend beyond work. Supporting a world of evolving needs, Tincata's innovations lead the way in user-centric design, technology, and sustainability around the globe. To learn more, please visit tincatafabrics.com.
Hey, Halton here, and I just want to take a few seconds to remind you we're just 4 weeks away from FDIC. Hot classes are filling up fast. There is space left in a few of the workshops. Please sign up now. Don't miss out on an opportunity to get CAPC credit, attend some of the greatest events in firefighting this April. Go to FDIC.com.
Welcome to this edition of Buildings on Fires, taking it to the streets, on your street, in your city, across the country, and around the world. Taking it to the streets is a monthly radio talk show program on fireengineering.com, Blog Talk Radio, and I'm your host, Christopher Naum. I'd like to thank our listeners for joining in on this episode of Taking It to the Streets, Buildings on Fire. We've got a nice little program, timely program, put together for you on this episode, talking about some of the emerging issues affecting the American Fire Service dealing with fires in commercial buildings. Many of you may recall we had the opportunity to do a three-part series back in the summer months. I think it was June through the September timeframe of 2020, talking about commercial buildings, both from the building construction and operational standpoint, building performance issues. And then we also did a program in March of 2021, talking about some of the evolving, challenging issues dealing with hybrid structures. On this edition, and again, based upon some of the continuing issues out there dealing with fires in commercial buildings, we're obviously seeing a trend occurring around the country. And this has been going on for quite a period of time here when we talk about not only here in 2022, but the number of events that have been occurring in the 2021 timeframe. Joining us on this episode is our good friend on Buildings on Fire and certainly a good friend of the American Fire Service, Captain Mike Lapina, out of Chicagoland area. Mike's going to be joining us here, talking a little bit about some issues here in a moment. We did have Assistant Chief Doug Klein out of Horry County that was scheduled to be on our show. However, he's running calls right now in the streets and in the areaways of Horry County, dealing with some weather-related conditions. So we do send our best to both Chief Klein and his firefighting force and all the personnel and citizens in his immediate area. So as I mentioned, I've got Captain Mike Lapina joining us. Mike, it's a pleasure to have you back on the show tonight. How's things going on your end?
Oh, very good. Very good. Busy teaching season here for the Illinois Fire Service Institute. So been busy with that.
Good for you. And you're back on the road here. I understand. I know that you did some postings on some social media over the last couple of days. So you're back on the road doing what you do best, right, brother?
Yeah. Yeah. Passing up the passing out the building construction message up in central Wisconsin this past weekend. Great time up there, Marathon County. Great people up there, small volunteer departments, but very eager to know, to find out what they can and know what they need to know. So they're very energetic.
And that's really the key items. You know, I was teaching about a week or so ago out in the West Coast and the same thing, you know, how do I know what I don't know if I don't know it? And that's really the whole emphasis that many of us, certainly you and I, and a number of other colleagues of ours that, you know, are good friends of our show and that have appeared on our show, Arthur Ashe, Danny Sheraton, Jim Duffy, Doug Klein, Jerry Tracy, Mike Robinson, again, just a lot of good people, Buck Henkel out of Philadelphia metro area and so forth, doing some exceptionally good things dealing with their sort of a niche on construction and operations, whether it be at the tactical level or for some of us talking about buildings and performance and construction. It's really the key items. So as I mentioned, you know, one of the things that we were thinking about that would be an appropriate discussion point for a good soundbite for our Buildings on Fire Taking the Streets episode, again, was dealing with the current trends around the United States over the last 18 to 24 months, but certainly of recent over the last number of months, certainly here in 2022, dealing with large area commercial fires, predominantly in both industrial, warehousing, storage types of structures, which seem to be popping up around the United States. Certainly some of the well-known companies that provide, for better words, commerce and materials. We'll leave the names nameless, but those companies that, again, have really proliferated during the COVID and pandemic standpoint, where everyone has been ordering from home and getting their materials and whatever their commodities are within a couple of days at their doorsteps. Those particular warehouses have been popping up throughout the United States in very specific geographical areas. You know, Mike, you and I were chatting before the show started. Just down the road here in my first due area, we've got a 3.5 million square foot warehouse and distribution center, second largest in the world. That's again, just 10 minutes down the road and within the first due of my former firehouse. And those are pretty common around the United States. We take a look at some of the things geographically. There are many listeners out there that know exactly what we're talking about. If we take a look and see what has evolved, if you ever fly into the Metroplex area of Dallas-Fort Worth, if you're ever into the Indianapolis area, flying into FDIC and Indy, there are, I'm just thinking here too, you can go into Seattle, you can go into any of the areas in California, Charlotte, another main hub, you fly into Charlotte, what is it that you're seeing as you're looking out of those windows? And it's nothing but building after building after building of these large area and what we call large volume commercial structures, especially with the warehouse and distribution facilities out there. So Mike, what's your sort of take? And we made mention that there have been a number of recent fires. And again, when we take a look at nationally, there have been a number of very high profile incidences that have occurred that have resulted in some very large property losses in terms of monetary losses, nothing in the way of significant firefighter injuries or fatalities, but that comes on the heel of a couple of very significant fires of a similar nature last year on the West Coast and in the Midwest. So what's your take on some of the things? What is it, a building issue? Is it a fire load issue? Is it a fire service issue? What's your soundbite on the issues out there with our commercial fires?
Yes, yes, and yes. So we have these warehouses, which, when you said you got the one that's 3.5 million square feet, we've got a couple 1.2 million type square foot warehouses that I can't imagine what three times that size looks like. But for sure, so we have these very large structures and they're packed to the gills with combustible and flammable materials. And these are the fires we've seen in these buildings have been in purpose-built warehouses. It'd be one thing if we said, oh, this warehouse that was that had, you know, XYZ furniture storage in it was a metal parts warehouse before, so they had a much lower fire protection system that somehow got overlooked and never got upgraded. These warehouses were purpose-built for what they have in them. Thus far, at least the ones that I've looked at, the few that we've had in the Chicago area, they've certainly taxed the system, but none of them ran away from firefighting efforts. You know what I mean? They were doing their job. They were screaming and they were hurting, but they were holding the fire in check. And I think, so to that end, the systems, however stressed they were working. They certainly needed to be augmented and supplemented and overtaken by firefighting efforts. But when it comes to the firefighting efforts, I think we need to do a better job of understanding how these buildings are laid out, how the stuff is packed in there, and you know, making sure we understand the how these, you know, they do still require a very aggressive and very heavy firefighting effort. You know, it's not, you know, and an understanding of these systems and saying that, you know, oh, sprinklers are going to extinguish it. No, that's not their purpose. They're, you know, especially when we're talking about these high fire loads, they're all they're doing is helping control it until you can get the really big water in there and finish extinguishment. So, I mean, I don't want to say that we're we're ignorant in a bad way. It's just we're not used to dealing with these buildings, and these buildings are like weeds out here. You know, we've had we have one of our suburbs up the road from me that in the early 90s had zero warehouses in their village, and by 10 years later they had over 400 non-combustible type 2 constructed warehouses, large, you know, 500,000 to 1 million square foot warehouses, 10 years. And that was 15 years ago. So now they've got to be close to 1,000 village wide. I mean, they've got a huge area of warehousing and manufacturing.
You know, I think that's a very common denominator with many jurisdictions around the United States. We're seeing what was somewhat uncommon in the 80s and 90s, where we had warehousing and manufacturing and what would typically be anything from, 30, 40, 50,000 square foot type of facility. You know, we started approaching the 100, 150,000, and that was large at that time. Right. I think when we take a look at the trends over the last 20, 30 years, or the late 90s throughout the 2000s here, the last 20 years, you know, the commonalities of having a 100 to 500,000 square foot facilities of various types has become the norm. And now we're seeing, you know, again, the norm get reset to being 1 million plus in many large metropolitan areas. So this continuing issue with distribution and the movement and products being stored or facilities and manufacturing, but these type two structures have become very common, both in the volunteer and the career side of it, but certainly the volunteer departments that have, or the combination systems that have these structures sizable in square footage in terms of their footprint, and then sizable in terms of volume, coupled with, as you just mentioned, the complexity of construction, coupled with the complexity of the fixed protective systems in there that have to go hand in hand. Now, you know, when we talk about construction, I think our listeners, when we talk about type two construction in particular, it's the most common within these types of settings. We think going back to the NFPA 220 standard, you know, it's all about a combination of a couple of things. It's the materials that go into that building, based upon the code provisions, as well as the protective systems, which again can be either passive or active, are going to be potentially zoned. But there's going to be everything from either some type of a fire suppression system or some type of a firefighting system regarding standpipes that may be there to help supplement a brigade, either official or unofficial, whatever that type brigade may be, or from the fire department standpoint. Because again, when we talk about these buildings, we're talking about footprints that are sizable relative to their geographical setting on the fire ground. And then the next big thing that certainly trends when we talk about today's building fires is the volume, right? When we talk about the sheer volume of these buildings coupled with the square footages of that footprint, this is a sizable building that's challenging at best, regardless of how many companies you've got coming on that first alarm or on that box and so forth. So a couple of things for our listeners, just from a historical standpoint. There were two very significant events that occurred back in the 80s that reset our way of thinking, even at that time frame. So, you know, we go back 30, 35 years, which for some of us, we lived through that time frame. But two very notable fires occurred, which did a check and an adjust for both the fire protection engineering community and the fire service community. And that included the 1982 Kmart fire in Pennsylvania and the 1987 Sherwin-Williams fire that occurred in Ohio. Those two events in themselves were unheard of when we talked about both in terms of size, severity, and the fact that these buildings were significantly consumed by fire, significant demands, and a lot of lessons that came out of them. But again, the biggest issues were operability of the protective systems and the manner in which the fire department interfaced with that incident. And that, I think, for our listeners, becomes the continuing challenge. Number one, we need to understand the construction of those buildings. Secondly, you need to understand intimately or have access to knowledgeable individuals on site of how those protective systems work. And then thirdly, the fire department needs to understand how they're going to interface in that building. So, you know, Mike, what are some of the features when you talk about construction? And I know, again, in the Chicagoland area, as well as both your travels, as well as mine, you know, we've seen a lot of building construction that's out there. I think our listeners need to recognize, too, that there are differences around the country, depending upon whether you're, you know, Northwest, or if you're in Central California or the Midwest, or, you know, Chicagoland to Middle Atlantic to Southeast to the Northeast. There are differences in the similarities, but at the same time, there are code differences. So, Mike, just run through a couple of bullet points on some of the issues dealing with type 2 construction regarding both the types of perimeter walls, types of roof systems that one's going to potentially find in there that would be of a concern, or some things that would be of interest to the first due companies, first due box, or the first due chief officer.
Sure. So primarily you're dealing, you know, with the type 2 that we see here, and most of these big box warehouses all over the place are nowadays tilt slab construction, and the tilts going anywhere from depending on the size, anywhere from 20 up to 40 or 50 feet tall, and ring around. They go up quick. They can get a 500,000 square foot warehouse built in a couple of weeks. You know, they pour a slab, throw the tilts up, some steel beams, and most, about the most you can span on the non-combustible, if I remember correctly, is about 60 feet. So they put their steel skeleton in, hang their bar joists across, and then usually it's some sort of corrugated pan roof. And then on top of that, they put the membrane and seal it down. And so, you know, you have, and then they load it. Some of the things that people overlook, I think, is they have a false sense of security with the non-combustible construction, thinking it's along the lines of fire resistant, which it is, in the sense that it is steel and concrete. However, it just doesn't have that minimal 2-hour rating to make it fire resistant. With that said, these buildings get loaded up with some sort of combustible materials, whether they're loaded to the gills or loaded appropriately or properly. They think, well, it's a steel building, it's not going to burn. And by definition, non-combustible construction doesn't, you know, it is a type of construction that, you know, metal does not burn. It doesn't produce flame or anything like that. But depending on fire loading, it does fail. And the reality is these metal trusses in these warehouses fail almost as quickly as our lightweight engineered wood. I mean, we can, the warehouse fire we had up the road from me 6 years ago, that system and the roof system and everything else, that building went from small fire to fully involved in about 10 minutes with complete collapse of the building and fully involved with the ferocity that fire burned. So again, we kind of overlooked that as a fire service. We overlooked the fact of how quickly these systems can fail when they are under extreme fire loads. But then some other features that we try to pass on to people is, you know, when people say, well, we're going to go up and vent the roof on this building, knock out some skylights, open up, if they have scuttles, we're going to open up that. And one of the things I point out to people is that when we talk about vertical ventilation and we talk about our standard 16 square foot 4x4 hole, that is for a roughly 1,000 square foot residential structure based on 1950s fire science and fire dynamics. So now we're dealing with a building that's 1,000 times larger. Does that mean you're going to cut, you know, you're going to try and cut a and today's fire materials, fire loading? Are you going to go up there and cut a 4,000 by, you know, or a 400 by 400 foot hole in the roof? You know, you are not going to be able to cut a hole big enough to vet that structure. Not only that, but something else that people overlook is that if we do have the, we do leave the sprinkler system on and we're actively allowing it to continue working while we try to extinguish that fire, people have to understand as well that by opening up the roof and having the sprinkler still going, that we are creating a Venturi effect and actually pulling air into the structure and keeping that smoke inside. Even if it does have the heat and the buoyancy to get out, the action of the Venturi effect of the sprinklers draws air in and actually keeps the smoke in the building, which hinders our ability to see what's going on and extinguish the fire. And then, you know, we have issues with systems potentially being shut down too soon, and, you know, then being overwhelmed. So, you know, we have to recognize all of these threats against us and figure out how to deal with it. Now, I know we have one of our departments in the area here that's very aggressive. They have a lot of warehouses, a lot of distribution warehouses. In fact, they protect one of the largest inland ports, if you will, in the United States with their intermodal facility and their warehousing. I know when they get into fire in one of these facilities, they are very aggressive. They leave the system in operation, and they have either warehouse workers that have been semi-trained or else their own guys who have been trained on forklifts that are able to wear air packs and such if the conditions are such. And they will go in and actively pull apart the rack storage and everything else so that they can get in and extinguishes. And it's not uncommon for them to be on the scene sometimes and relatively small fires inside these facilities. It's not uncommon for them to be on the scene for 5, 6, 10 hours sometimes, diligently pulling the stuff apart and making sure that fire is out. And one of the things that was talked about with one of the fires recently up here was that they recognized that that's the sort of thing that they have to start going to. This other department said that, oh, we need to look into that.
It's interesting, you know, we talk about tactical approaches. Conventional tactics will not work in these structures. And I think that has to be first and foremost clearly understood by any organization that has these structures either in their primary response areas or maybe responding in a mutual aid or greater alarm capacity. I think first and foremost, the fire service needs to recognize the uniqueness of these buildings relative to risk and frequency of potential fire conditions. We're very common. I think, you know, I can recall going to alarm drops and alarm activations and to various types of properties years ago. And again, complacency, you know, you're not expecting something to occur. But when it did occur, the ability for that fire to grow both in severity and magnitude in such a short period of time and to really get into a deep-seated condition needs to be recognized and embraced, because it will affect and certainly challenge and stress any organization if they're behind the eight ball to begin with. I think that, you know, you made mention of a couple of things regarding the construction and commodities. So typically we see a variety of different construction and materials in these structures, and I would encourage our listeners to take a look at what's common in your particular response areas, what's common to the region that you may be operating and working within, to see what kinds of combination of materials are typical of those particular structures. And again, they may be typical based upon vintage and age in which they were built. And also there's some commonalities based upon the footprint and the volume of those buildings. As the building increases in size and complexity, sometimes you're going to see some variations or a hybrid system, as Mike just talked about, regarding the spans and the frequency of the bay spacing, the spanning of various areas based upon what's being stored regarding the size and square footage, and then also the degree of protection for either single or multiple hazard commodities. So in other words, you may have a variety of material that's in that building in certain areas that may have different levels of risk, which should have a different engineered suppression system that's going to be present to be able to control that fire and support the extinguishment of that fire in support of the fire department. And again, Mike, excellent comment when you talk about it's really not meant to put the fire out. It's a fixed suppression system is really there to help control it, along with other manual efforts that normally have to take place because of how and where the products may be stored. You made mention of high rack storage. And again, for our listeners, you may not even realize that you very well may have high rack, high density storage facilities, which has become more and more common. I can remember the first high rack storage in our first dew area back in the 80s. And again, it was such a novelty, but now, again, travels, you see that time and time all over because footprints become smaller or limiting, and the only way to go is up. And the one thing that our listeners need to recognize sometimes is that that high rack storage in many instances is also part of a structural support system for the perimeter walls and many times for the roof systems. They're an integrated type of system. The other thing Mikey made mention of, and our listeners, again, we've had the opportunity to talk about a couple of historical things going on, but I quickly made a quick note here. 1953, the General Motors plant fire in Livonia, Michigan. That was a significant fire back in the day due to the size of that building, the fact that, again, the height factor of that building away from what was expected to catch fire, the thought process at that time was that the fire will never get hot enough to cause the, you know, roofing system to become impacted by flame or heat impingement and so forth. But what they didn't recognize, and Brannigan did a great, great job about writing about this in his first edition of his building construction book. When he talked about Livonia, he talked about the migration of heat up into the upper deck, Q decking, and at that time built up tar and roofing material on that Q deck. So when we have heat on a metal component or a metal pan, meaning the Q deck, right?
Right.
Heating up, and you've got the bituminous tar on top of that that's heating up and starts boiling with the felts on top of that that's acting as a heat sink. The one thing nobody recognized was that as everything started heating up and all of that tar started heating up, it started really releasing gases between the joints of the Q deck. And once that gas was released, elevated temperatures, what did we end up having, Mike? We had self-ignition. Now we, had a self-propagating roof deck fire that really challenged that department and actually knocked him into the ground. I mean, in other words, that fire department at that time could not suppress the fire, and that fire ran rampant, destroying the entire General Motors building at the time. And again, if you go online and take a look at a couple of video clips, there's some exceptional historical information for our listeners out there to understand that. And we fast forward here to 2022. And, you know, Mike, you and I have had some conversations offline about some continuing commentary that some of these fires have resulted in online. And the one misconception has been how the roof systems may be contributing. They talked about a lot about the potentials of, you know, collapsing walls, whether they were tilt up or just precast. I mean, there's a big difference, right? There's a difference between precast or metal pan, putting them on a girt system or a true tilt up type of construction system, as well as the variety of roofing systems. So there's a lot of inaccurate information that continues to be going on out there, especially when you read commentary after these fires. And then also a misconception about control aspects. You know, Mike mentioned about some issues dealing with roof venting. There's, they may or may not be present. So one of the things that our listeners should be thinking about when they go out and start pre-fire planning is to, you know, get the aerials up, you know, get the Google map brought up on your smartphone or your iPad, and take a look at what's on top of that roof. Is there the presence of, number one, fire separations? Are there firewalls, fire barriers that are going to be indicative of various types of roof and parapet systems? And then the absence or presence and the frequency and the spacing of any type of roof vents. Now, there are going to be a variety of different roof vents out there. There are going to be those that are tied into various types of heat sink devices that will automatically open up based upon elevated temperatures with the fusible links. There are others that may be tied in and will actually fail based upon elevated heat conditions, and then the thermoplastic will fail, allowing for an open condition. One, you have the ability to control that opening if the roof hatches have opened up. Again, you can selectively control vent and flow paths. The others, once they the thermal elements fail, you just have a whole series of openings. So we've got a couple of things. Mike, you know, you talked about ventilation, and I'll ask you this question. So we've got the vertical ventilation with our roof vents. And then in many instances, we have loading dock areas or in distribution locations, we have series of, you know, door upon door upon door, sizable overhead doors that sometimes are going to be at least 10, 12 feet across, 14 feet across, and in some instances, 12 or 14 feet in height, which when we take a look at those bays for the loading docks and where the tractor trailers are, that creates a sizable vent and flow path. So
yes,
buildings, right, these buildings, as you mentioned, the Venturi effect and so forth, will result in some very challenging conditions if one does not recognize how ventilation will work for you. And more importantly, just the simple aspect and task level of opening a couple of doors may be very detrimental, right?
Right. Oh, yeah. And we've seen that, you know, unfortunately. And, yeah. There's so much. Sometimes you make my head spin, Chris, because there's just so much to discuss with this and so little time.
And that's just it, Mike. So here's what we've got. So we got two guys here that are talking that know our stuff on construction. And as we're trying to lay out some pieces and provide some breadcrumbs for you, the listener, who's listening in to try to get some insights. And that's all we're trying to do. We're trying to give you some insights on some things. And I think we've succeeded in such a short time frame in our episodes so far, is that, Mike, just as you said it, you know, there's just so many different layers. It's not, number one, a simple, simple tactical template. It's not a simple tactical worksheet that one's going to pull up. It's not simply just having a bunch of apparatus showing up and you're calling a second or third alarm. You got your greater alarms coming in, whatever it may be. You may either have an inadequacy or you may have an unlimited supply of resources, but how you use those resources tactically and how command interfaces with the building systems, the protective systems, the facilities, resources that are going to be the most knowledgeable of what it is that's going on in those buildings, and then have an appreciation of what type of options one might be able to apply regarding the strategies and tactics. I think our listeners can have a greater appreciation at this point that it's not simple. It's not a simple issue, which in itself, Mike, right, may actually be a contributor to why we're seeing some very good departments out there having some significant challenges, right? And so there's been some great jobs being done, good fires being put out, buildings being saved, property losses at a minimum. But one of the things we said right up front was that we're seeing these adverse trends. We're seeing the frequency of these fires, and we're seeing the frequency of large property losses from a financial standpoint impacting that community. Right. And there's no simple answer, right? you've read those comments, I've read the comments, and those comments sometimes are how far off base, Mike?
Not even the same.
Be nice sport. About it. Be nice about it, right?
Not even the same sport. and again, it's well-intentioned, and I look at things like from a tactical standpoint. You know, you look at just basic fundamental firefighting. We've always been told, you know, little fire, little water, big fire, big water. So, you know, yes, our, as much as I hate to use the term bread and butter house fires, I'm saying that from a fire flow standpoint. Most of our regular older style houses and even some newer houses in the 1,000 to 2,000 square foot range, we can handle with 1 or 2 inch and 3/4 a standard room and contents fire. I know my friends down in Lake Ozark Fire Protection District down in central Missouri, they have a standard operating guideline, standard operating procedure, actually, that says any house over, I want to say 30, but basically any house over 3,000 square feet, they treat as a commercial building fire, i.e. automatically dropping big lines, search ropes, stuff like that. They are an extremely aggressive fire department. They don't burn their houses down. And they're, if you look at some of their houses, how they're located geographically, they have some severe challenges to get to these houses. My point with that is that they're identifying larger residential structures to be treated as commercial building fires. So they play 2.5 as their go-to first out hand line. With that said, when we're talking about these larger commercial building fires, we are talking about not 1 or 2 or 3 2.5 inch hand lines. We are talking about multiple master streams, our ground monitors, multiversals, whatever terminology we want to use for these, 500 to 1,000 GPM ground monitors. This is not a 1 or 2, 2.5 type of fire. These are heavy volume fires with this fire loading, especially when we're talking about 3 and 4 and 5 story warehouses with the way they're laid out. Not so much, certainly for the volume, because again, the fire loading of these buildings, not just the volume, but also the reach to reach up to these upper levels where the fire is going to be, not within reach of our hand line. So we need to consider that as part of our tactics is getting into, hey, we're going to have to drop, a couple ground monitors in here. And I can remember back to a boat warehouse in the city of Chicago back about probably 25, 30 years ago. They had a warehouse that was housing boats, and a couple of the boats caught on fire. They had no qualms about bringing the snorkel right into the building and setting the snorkel up inside and letting it go to town. And that undoubtedly saved not only the structure, but also the boats inside. And that was, again, about 25, 30 years ago. And just recently here, in fact, about the same week as the warehouse fire up in Bartlett, a large vessel marina storage facility up in Waukegan, Illinois, where my father happens to have his boat stored, that building suffered a fire. And Waukegan Fire Department did a phenomenal job. Because they have an airport and they have a ARF rig up there, they brought the ARF rig in and pulled that into the bay door and let that rip. And they actually saved all but, I think, 3 boats in the building that were destroyed. But it's those kind of aggressive tactics. Now, that being said, there have also been examples that I've seen videos of where they pull an engine or a crash truck or something into the building, and because they're trying to be aggressive, they don't necessarily read the building, so to speak, and they end up losing an engine. So I'm not necessarily advocating that you pull your rig inside the building. I'm saying you got to read the room and understand what you're getting into. But we need that next level aggressiveness and fire flow to get these things out in a quick and efficient manner. Just like we said, we can pull a you know, an inch and three quarter, an inch and a half on a house fire, and, you know, you flow it for 10 or 15 minutes, that fire will eventually either run out of stuff to burn, or eventually you will get enough water on the fire. But in the process, you're going to get a lot more damage. So it's the same thing where, you know, why flow an inch and three quarter for 10 minutes at 150 GPM when I can hit that fire with a 2.5 at 250 and only flow for 2 minutes and only flow, say, 300 or 500 gallons versus the 1500 gallons over 10 minutes that it would take to control the fire. So, you know, again, the fire getting away from us in these large buildings, notwithstanding, we have to come with a heavier punch. It's not our standard hand line fire.
That's a great, great point. When we take a look at the tactical window still remains the same. You have a 10 to 15 minute time frame of effectiveness, a little bit more regarding these buildings versus our more common residential, small level, 30,000 square foot or less commercial, multiple occupancy and so forth. But that tactical window still remains tight. And you bring up some great points in terms of suppression issues. I think that we got to look at mobility. How do we get from curbside or street side into that building, and the tactical mobility to get to the point in which we are going to be undertaking our efforts. So sometimes there's quite a bit of time lag to just get into that building due to the footprint. So that's point number one. The air management portion of it is critical. When we talk about being on air as we right. start entering and experiencing IDLH atmospheres, which again also provides a stressor regarding our ability to work for an extended period of time in a safe environment, and then still have to manage our escape routes to go out, replenish, and so forth. So that is a stressor on the strategic side of operations. Just the fact that the buildings are considered to be closed structures, meaning that we don't have immediate accessibility to outside perimeter walls. If we're working in particular bays or isolated zones within the building, again, are further stressors, both on firefighter safety, tactical operations, the movement of products of combustion, the extinguishment portion of it. Again, we are going to be fighting the fire within a particular area within that building that's going to be affecting other areas, meaning the bays and particular zones and areas throughout that structure. There may not be a defense in place. In other words, there may not be critical firewalls that are proximal. They may not be close to our operations, or they may be very, very removed, meaning that in combination with the sprinkler system, coupled with the commodities, the manner in which they're stored, whether there's manufacturing or other activities, you may have a sizable amount of square footage and a distance to get to a particular area of refuge or an exit way to get out, which further puts demands on the operation. So again, for our listeners, you know, strategic tactical operations, there's a whole different series of management, even just as simple as gaining access. And when we talk about tactical mobility, again, think about, well, when I came in, I can see where I'm going. I can see where the exit ways are, the travel paths, you know, so many feet in the distance. But what happens when all of that becomes obscured by smoke movement? It's not
correct.
The place is not on fire, but the smoke migration now has resulted in diminished or no longer being able to see where that travel path is. So, you know, are you on a tagline? Is there some ability that you're going to figure out landmarks? I mean, lobby control and other things all come into play here, but we end up defaulting back to what, Mike? We end up, all right, something starts going dicey. We have some maydays. Guys are not able to see and so forth. And next thing we know, we're popping roof vents up, or we're opening up all these doors. And then what happens? Well,
right.
It's all predictable, right? It's all entirely predictable based upon the sequence of events, because we aren't able to read the buildings and have an appreciation for, I guess, for better words. And we've used this term a number of times in all of our shows, and have an adaptive fire ground management perspective. In other words, we have to be considering a variety of options. And Mike, you made some great comments about, you know, apparatus placements both in and around the building, and master streams, gallon per minute flow rates. You know, it's all about the rate of heat release, what we are becoming inundated with, and hopefully becoming much more familiar with when we talk about rated heat release of the fire load packages. Now we're taking that fire load package and increasing it in magnitude or severe in series of magnitude. We talk about stuff that's being stored, stuff that's going to be within these large, you know, footprinted bay areas, both in terms of square footage and then volume. Again, it's the stuff that's going to be upward in these shelving areas. So for our listeners, you know, there's so many different layers here of operational perspectives. We'll go back to some fundamentals, Mike. You know, I think we could be talking about this for another hour easily, and I think we'll have an opportunity for another show here to put some further commentary together. But our listeners need to recognize, I think, a couple of things. And we've always talked about it, Mike. You have always been a major proponent about getting out there and looking and reading and sizing up your buildings. And again, for our listeners, NFPA 1620 is the standard for pre-incident planning. You got to get yourselves, your companies out there formally or informally, but I would highly recommend in a formal setting, meet up with the facility owners, identify what resources may be present on site that can help you, identify the resources that have technical knowledge of how that building operates in terms of both its protective systems, as well as the layout and how to move through that building, and then help support the next initiative, try to figure out what's going to be appropriately needed on a first alarm, and then pre-plan out your greater alarm responses and do that robustly in the least amount of time, right? Don't be afraid of calling that second, third, or whatever the general alarm may be. And it's literally getting the right resources early on. Mike, you talked about this. The quicker you can get that resources in and operational, sometimes that's going to be the difference between saving a sizable amount of the building versus, you know, evacuating and getting into a defensive posture and, you know, having a whole different outcome from that standpoint.
Yeah, and something to your point about the pre-fire planning is it has to be realistic and it has to be achievable. You know, as I sit here and say, yeah, these fires require master stream type fire flows, not hand lines. You can't just write down on a piece of paper and say, okay, we're going to use master streams on these fires. You need to get out there, you know, take the measuring wheel, find out how many feet it is from whatever door 65 or whatever, if that's going to be your fire attack for this part of the building is going to be door 65 because it has the most access to the whatever center of the building, north side of the building, whatever. So you say, okay, let's get in here, walk this, wheel it out, find out how much, you know, if we have master streams that use large diameter hose, how much hose are we going to have to drop out to make a fire in the center of this wing of the building, so to speak? Not just saying, yeah, we get a fire here, we're going to drop a master stream. Cool, problem solved, we're good. Okay, let's wait. No, you need to go out and proactively physically size these buildings up, physically measure this stuff out. I can, you know, we've done that on buildings, going out and not just looking at them and saying, hey, if we get a fire here, this is what we're going to do. Not just this is what we're going to do, this is what we'd like to do, this is how we'd like to do it. Now let's go and see, short of actually dropping the lines and flowing water in the building, let's make sure that the hose we carry on our rigs, you know, can reach this part of the building sufficiently. Let's make sure that if we're going to do this, I'm not just talking about having my 2 or 3 man engine company there. This is going to involve multiple companies to get the first line in operation. Our still alarm assignment of 4 engines, a ladder, and 2 ambulances, quite possibly all 5 of those companies, all 5 of those first in companies could be tasked with just getting that first master stream in operation, you know. And so, you know, that's, you have to walk these things out and make sure the thing that you have in your head is what you're actually going to be able to carry out, because you don't want to get there. And that was one of those things, at least early in my career, people, we talk about pre-planning, but then it became, oh, no, we can't pre-plan, because when you pre-plan And if the building burns down, they'll come back and sue you because you said you were going to fight the fire this way and you didn't do that. And the building still burned down and whatever, you know, whatever else. So we stopped doing pre-plans for a little bit because we didn't want to get sued. But it's like, no, that's, you know, we're coming up with a guideline. We're coming up with, we have to have a workable plan in place. All those other external problems, fire loading and size of the fire, all that stuff before we get there, that's out of our control. But if what we can control is how we'd like to approach this. So again, getting out there and working, making sure our plan is workable and achievable and not just something that looks good on paper.
Yeah, those are excellent words of wisdom. I would encourage our listeners too. I mean, again, we're talking about sizable buildings that have a lot of complexities to them. And we've got to go to fight the fight with the same degree of complexity on our end. In other words, you've got to have those resources, building intel information, data that should be loaded up, whether it be on something as simple as your smartphone or your tablet or your iPad. I mean, these are given, guys. So it's no longer going to be acceptable where the availability of that kind of building intelligence and information is not readily accessible, available, and has been preloaded. So, you know, you're not doing your job if you're showing up and this is the first time you're putting your eyes inside that building. Again, it does demand of you, if you have one or 100 of these buildings, the investment of time and effort to document, gain as much information, put it into a repository system which is accessible so it can be utilized. You know, I made mention about a very complex building in our first do here. And again, when we talk about pressurized stairwells, the sophistication of the riser system, density levels of the sprinkler system, different commodities and different zones and areas, and the whole aspect of how that building was designed, both from a code standpoint and a fire protection standpoint. And then lastly, the types of uniqueness that go into the building. So Mike and I have been talking about construction issues. The one thing that we have constantly talked about in all of our episodes at some point is how dramatically the codes changed about 20 plus years ago, going from prescriptive to performance based. And the one given that I think everyone needs to recognize is that your building, although similar in style, design, construction features, may be very, very unique based upon what your authority having jurisdiction allowed the builder, the architect, and the owner to have in terms of trade-offs based upon that code that went into that building. And that's a given. If you think that all of our buildings are all the same, East Coast to West Coast, guys, you're just fooling yourself, because what went into that building, although may follow the generally accepted practices up to some point, guess what? You may have allowed some things based upon whatever it may be that's going into that building, which have created a standalone building that may be very unique and also may require some very unique and innovative processes when you show up on scene and got to go to work. So, you know, in a brief, short 1 hour segment here, we talked about a lot of things. Mike, I really want to thank you for your continued insights. You know, these conversations become more and more layered because we just delve into so many other areas here. And hopefully our listeners have an appreciation because, you know, we're investing quite a bit of time to give you good, accurate technical information, and more importantly, give you some insights to move forward to do some more research. You know, no one individual out there has all the answers. And if somebody that you're listening to on a podcast is trying to tell you this is the way it's got to be, kid, and so forth, I would reconsider listening to that program, because not everyone has the answers. There's a lot of variables out there, and we encourage you to do a couple of things. Number one, continue to learn more about your buildings. In the areas of commercial construction, especially for those that are over that 100,000 square foot and above, you know, up to about the 500,000-600,000 square foot, there's a lot of commonalities. Once you start going past 500,000 square feet on up, or have hit that critical bullet point of a million plus, those buildings very much have unique operating conditions, tactical considerations, building performance. I mean, there's just a lot of things that we could talk about those specifically, right, Mike, about key bullets on those that are in categories. And that's something that we're working towards trying to develop for a future program, maybe the summer or this fall, where we've come up with some categories of building sizes, similar to what we've done with our mega mansions. But there are some things that fall within a certain realm of building sizes, construction that's common to those sizes, and then some suggested operational considerations. And I think that'll be one of our future programs here for our listeners to keep tabs on. Mike, any takeaways, any closing comments here before we close out our show?
No, I mean, hit it again. You got to get out and look at these buildings. You got to understand what you're looking at. You have to recognize the deficiencies. When I say deficiencies, it's not necessarily a nefarious or a malicious deficiency, but deficiencies in the system. Again, going back to my friend, the performance code versus prescriptives and the giveaways that we give, understanding that and not just saying, oh, it's a sprinkler building, we're fine. Well, wait a minute, this warehouse just got built in a semi-urban area or an urban area where maybe the water mains haven't been improved because, oh, it's a sprinkler building. You don't have to do that. AKA Edgewater, New Jersey, those kind of deficiencies that are allowed to happen that are going to impact how we do our job. And again, going back to the pre-planning, we're going to drop 5 ground monitors on this. Cool. Your hydrants outside can only supply 500 GPM. So, you're not going to get that fire flow out of those 5 ground monitors. Just understanding that stuff and going out and planning that and making yourself aware of what's in your neighborhood. And for lack of better words, planning for the worst and hoping for the best in terms of, hey, if we get a heavy volume of fire or something happens in this building, this is what we're going to go for. And we'll scale it back from there. Anything beyond this, we're not going to be able to handle. Take the loss. Anything up to this, we're going to go as hard as we can, but can we make it there? Are we too ambitious? Whatever. Figure it out.
And those are great words. And again, conservative bias, know your district, know your building, have enough resources on the front end. Sometimes that high rise pack going in is not going to have that smooth bore tip on it. It's going to have that stinger or portable monitor that really, and if you have 3 or 4 of those, that, again, you've got to rethink the game plan of what it is that's going to be the most effective. And these buildings demands a lot of thinking outside of the box. So again, for our listeners, I want to certainly thank you for taking time out of your schedule to listen to our program on this edition of Buildings on Fire, Taking the Streets, talking about some insights on the trending issues dealing with commercial fires. Again, stay engaged. I think you'll see some additional programs that we'll have available in the upcoming months. So until next time, companies are in quarters and off the air. Stay safe, but keep in mind there's a job being worked somewhere in the streets in your city, across the country and around the world, doing what we do best and being who we are, firefighters. Take care, everyone. Until next time, it's Chris Knob signing off. Captain Mike Lupino from Chicagoland signing off. We'll talk to you guys next time around. Stay safe, everyone.
Thank you much, guys. Take care.